Buenas noches, amigos. This is John Lovell. It's episode 59 of the Book Exchange Podcast. I'm here as ever with my co-host, Jude Lovell, and we're back with another episode. Jude, what's going on tonight?
Buenas noches, hermano. That's my attempt to speak Spanish.
That was wonderful. We are recording at night, which we don't usually do. It's a weeknight. We try to record on the weekends because, as we always say, we're busy family men, but this is the best time we could do it. So here we are with episode 59. This is the second of our Read Around the World episodes. So you may wonder why we threw a little Spanish in there. Well, that's because tonight's episode is Read Around the World, colon Mexico. We're going to be talking about all things literary having to do with Mexico. Obviously, we're not going to cover the whole thing, not even close. And as is our sort of tradition for these shows, neither of us have been. Well, I was going to say I've been to Mexico. I actually have been to Mexico. I was there for about 10 minutes, which, you know, I may get to at some point. I stood on Mexican soil, let's put it that way. And I approached it from an unusual angle, given that we're coming from the United States. But maybe that'll come up later. But so our first read around the world. What's that?
It's better than I've done.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you haven't been there, unfortunately. But that's the purpose of these shows. I think just to recap, we did one, maybe about 4 or 5 episodes back, called Read Around the World, Australia, New Zealand, and Tasmania. And it's essentially our sort of like way to sort of travel to these places that we've never been. We may do some episodes about places that we have been at least once. For example, Ireland. Both of us have been to Ireland. But we want to do these sort of like special episodes where we take a look at books and literature and writers from a specific region of the world. And part of the reason is just curiosity. And part of the reason is to acquaint ourselves with different writers from that part of the world. So we're going to take on Mexico in tonight's episode. I'm really excited about it. Turns out, you know, the more I thought of it, I've read a lot of books that were set in Mexico or about Mexico in one way or another. And I think you would probably agree, Jude, that there's, you know, you've probably read more than you thought that center or focus on that region in one particular way or another.
Yeah. And by the way, we do have some listeners in Mexico. I don't know how many, but if you're hearing this and you're in Mexico, greetings and thanks for all the great literature. But it's weird. I when I went through my list, John, I was preparing for the show. It's kind of both for me. I discovered at least through lists I've been keeping the last 20 or 25 years that I had not read as many as I thought that were actually written by people who were Mexican. But then again, I found a nice, I'd say like a really diverse listing of books that I have read from that area. So I was sort of pleasantly surprised by the diversity. Maybe I haven't read as much as perhaps I should. But, you know, John, as Pierce Pettis once said, it's a great big world. So, you know.
Indeed it is. And that, again, that's part of the reason why we like to do these episodes, because we're trying to get acquainted with different parts of the world that we may not otherwise be acquainted with. Sometimes the best way to do that, if you're not able to travel there, you know, physically yourself, is to, explore the art, explore the culture, explore the literature, and that's what we're trying to do. So this one is going to be fun. As usual, it's going to go all over the place, you know, both literally and figuratively. I know I've got a long list of books that I want to at least touch on and, you know, recommend. So this should be cool. This should be cool.
Yeah, I agree.
Anything administratively or anything you want to bring up, Jude, before we kind of jump into the show?
Not really. You know how to reach out to us. If you've listened to our show, let us know what you think. Suggestions for other people around the world. But other than that, no, I think we can dive in. We got a lot of ground to cover. Mexico is a big nation.
That's right. And you mentioned there, you know, we do have listeners in other countries. If you're a listener from another country other than the United States and, you know, you're eager to have us jump into or get acquainted with the literature from your part of the world, we'd love to do that. So let us know. Otherwise, we're going to do things the way we always do, Jude. We'll talk about what we've been reading, you know, briefly, and then we'll jump into the actual content of the episode. So how about it? What have you been reading these days?
Well, John, I'm glad you asked that. We got to build in suspense for each other, the hosts here, however we can. So I'm reading something. I'm actually quite excited about it. I'll try to keep it brief, and I have not told you what it was. Well, I'm kind of doing, this summer I've been doing something unusual because I'm still reading that large horror anthology that I mentioned in the last few episodes called The Dark Descent. I'm actually still reading that book. I've cut into it more times than I normally would do. But, you know, an anthology is good for that. So I still have about 150 pages to go in that horror anthology. But I'm reading a brand new novel, John, that I don't know if you would have even heard of. And it has an unusual title. The novel is called The Bee Sting. Does that ring a bell to you at all?
No.
I'm just curious.
No.
Okay. Well, for years, there's an Irish writer that I'm a big fan of who I've been kind of had my eye peeled out, who's only put out four novels, and between novels, something like 6 or 7 years usually goes by. And about 10 or 12 years ago, this guy put out a novel that's still one of my favorite contemporary books. I've mentioned it in many episodes, most notably in the episodes about the funniest books we've ever read. The novel's name is Paul Murray, and the book that he's probably best known for was that funny book, a big book, called Skippy Dies,
yeah,
which was published in 2010. Paul Murray has published one other novel since then, up until very recently. It was a book called The Mark in the Void. And that all I know is that it was written about the financial crisis of 2008. And it was kind of another big novel sort of in the world of financial services, you know, and like wealth management, which is kind of weird. Anyway, he has a brand new book out. It's another big novel. It's like 600 and something pages. It's called The Bee Sting. And I won't go on a lot about it. I'm about a third of the way through the book. I love this writer. I don't know what it is. There's some kind of magic in the way he writes big novels. I've only read the one other novel, Skippy Dies, but it's a very compelling story. It's kind of a family epic set in kind of modern Ireland with these two adults, you know, this married couple raising two teenage children. And it so far it just kind of gets really deep into their family history. And the bee sting is, wouldn't want to give it away, but it's a reference to something that happened that made kind of a tragic farce out of a wedding, with literally getting a bee getting trapped in a bonnet, or in this case, a wedding veil. And it started this whole kind of tragic comic saga with this one family in Ireland. And I'm in the middle of it. I'm reading it. It's very funny. It's kind of moving. I have absolutely no idea where it's going or where it's going to go. I got like 350 or 400 pages left. And it could just do anything. And it has a lot of experimental styles in it too. I really love the book. But anyway, that's what I'm reading it now. And I'm just very curious to see where this book is going to go, because I have no idea. So anyway, the book's called The Bee Sting. And Paul Murray is a novelist that I think people should keep an eye on. So over to you.
Well, that's pretty wild. I hadn't heard of that book, and it just sounds like it's just like a family drama. But I don't know much about Paul Murray. I've never read him. I know you've talked to me a number of times about that book, Skippy Dies. So that's sort of a simple story too, but it has some strange elements to it. So I'm sure not everything is what it seems in this book, The Bee Sting. So it'll be interesting to see where it goes. Did you get that out from your library, or did you find it somewhere?
Yeah, I stumbled across it and it had come out, and I had just kind of been paying attention here and there. Always meant to read Mark in the Void, but I never read it. And then I saw something about it, and I just decided to check, see if the library had it, and they had it. And just because I love Skippy Dice so much, I just said, I'm going to get it. So I did.
That's right. Yeah, you just get it on the strength of, you know, a previous book that the guy wrote. We talk about it all the time. There's some writers you just read something from and you're like, I'd pretty much try anything by that guy or by that gal.
So well, I'm gonna make you read a book by Paul Murray someday. You can count on that.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever even seen one, but you know, someday I'll probably get to it. I'm sure. Maybe for this show, who knows? Well, you mentioned like long books that we've been reading off and on throughout the last several months, and I'm in the middle of one of those myself. Although I'm happy to read, and that would be anybody who's listened to this show for the last few episodes knows that I've been dipping back, you know, on and off again into this large biography of Frederick Douglass. I made it to the last 50 pages. So,
yay. Congratulations.
I said on this show that I vowed I was going to finish it, and I am going to finish it. And I'll just say what I've been saying all along. It's outstanding. It has been interesting on every page. That has lasted to page 700, which is approximately what I'm on now. And it's going to be all over in about 750. So I'm getting to the end of Douglass's life and the book. And it's just, you know, I'm not going to get into it here, but it's just I think I can safely say now, it's one of the most interesting biographies I've ever read. Certainly of an American figure. There's no doubt about that. I said this before, it's right up there with some of these long sort of magisterial biographies that David McCullough has written, in my opinion. So I'm about to be finished with that. And I've been, you know, kind of coming in and out of it, which is, like you said, not something we normally do. But for this show, you know, reading different things, I read a number of books in preparation for this particular episode and also for the previous episode, which was Ghosts, I believe, the one we did about Ghosts. So, you know, it's just, you know, part of our commitment to this program, you know, to prepare for these episodes. So, and this book, like the one you've been reading, the horror anthology, is just so long, you know, but I was committed to it, wanted to finish it, and I'm just about there. So it's been, I'll probably, in one way or another, I'm going to talk about this biography a little bit more on this program at some point, but it's outstanding. I couldn't possibly recommend it any higher. So, as you know, you gave me that book, so thank you for that. And, you know, that covers what we've been reading. I think, you know, without any further, you know, ado here, we can jump right into the topic of the show. Once again, this is Read Around the World. Today, we're taking on the region of Mexico. Do you have anything else you need to say before we start to dive in?
The only thing I want to say is congratulations on almost reaching the end of that Frederick Douglass biography. What an effort. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but the publisher actually, if you actually finish that book and you can prove it, they send you like a master's degree. Like American Studies. That's because of like how smart you got when you were reading that book. I'm just kidding, of course. But anyway, that's great that book is so good. And, you know, I look forward to seeing something about that towards the end of the year.
Well, it begs the question what kind of degree they're going to send to you for finishing the dark horror anthology. You know, like maybe they'll just send you a free Ouija board or something.
Yeah, right. I don't know. I'm going to change my address, you know.
So, Jude, I'm excited to dive in. You know, it's fascinating with Mexico because obviously, you know, we are recording this show as Americans living in America. We share a rather large border with the country of Mexico. There are, you know, other than Canada, our most immediate neighbors directly south of us. And our histories are intertwined in all kinds of interesting ways as well. In the way that I read, you know, my list is sort of a mix of fiction and nonfiction. And, you know, the history of Mexico is really fascinating stuff. You know, and you say Mexico, that, you know, Mexico only became known as Mexico, you know, I don't know exactly when, but, you know, sometime roughly around what we would call the Middle Ages. But of course, before that, you know, there were a number of indigenous, you know, nations and tribes that populated what we now know as Mexico that go way, way back. So this is a country with a rich and vast history of its own, a lot of which we don't know that much about, and goes sort of like our own history, you know, and what is now known in the United States. You know, the people have been here a long, long time, but we don't know a whole lot about the civilizations that came before. So there's a lot of commonalities with our histories, and there's obviously a lot of differences. It's just, it's a country with a rich, rich history, rich culture, multiple cultures kind of coming together. It's a melting pot of a different sort than America is. That's for sure. And it's just fascinating. And there are so many books that kind of explore different aspects of that. I think, you know, with what we cover today, we're going to, listeners will come away from with a real appreciation for what a fascinating and rich and mysterious history and sort of culture that Mexico is. So we're going to try to honor that with our selections here. I know I've got, I had so many books that I kind of wanted to at least mention that I'm going to go through my selections sort of by category. I'm going to have, you know, 1 to 2 books that I want to recommend in different sort of genres or in different styles. So that's how I'm going to do it. But I know that you have, you know, a list of like 5 or 6 books that you wanted to focus on. So I'm going to turn it to you and let you kick us off. I don't know if you have a particular order you want to follow or what, but, you know, talking about books that we have read or may want to recommend or just have found fascinating, what are some of the books that came to mind for you that you knew that you were going to have to discuss for this show? Or if you want to just start off with one, that's fine.
Yeah, maybe I'll start off with one. So my list, you know, this is very typical of us. My list is entirely fiction. And I have, I think, about 6 titles. I don't know if I'll get to them all, but I'll, you know, at least mention them all. And I would say mine, you know, these are like sort of my favorite Mexican books, although some of them I just read in preparation for this show. My favorite books about Mexico and or, you know, books that I would just sort of recommend to listeners of this podcast, they want to check out Mexican literature. So I'll just dive right in with the first one. The first one that I wanted to talk about is like, you know, the most old school, at least in terms of, you know, my reading life. I'd be curious to know like what listeners remember this book. So I'm kind of a sucker for, as you know, John, especially as I get older, maybe it's just nostalgia, but like the big, kind of the big epic books from like the 1970s and 80s. I would call them like sort of epic page turners of a historical, epic historical page turners. So like big sort of sweeping sagas set in other places that are kind of long, epic voyages through that particular place. And I'm talking about stuff like Shogun, you know, James Clavell.
Or, yeah.
The Pillars of the Earth, Ken Follett, which you talked about, or maybe The Thorn Birds, which I've never read. Yep. Maybe Lonesome Dove in America. You know, those sort of books like that, like these big fat.
Or the Leon Uris books.
Yeah, like the books they really, I've talked about this before, books they really don't kind of make novels like this anymore. I feel like, you know, these kind of sweeping sagas, they might have had like sort of a limited literary value, whatever that means, or sort of limited literary merit, but man, they were just like swashbuckling stories. And so the first one I want to bring up without going on too great length is a book people might remember. It was actually published in 1980. It was written by Gary Jennings, and the book's called Aztec. And I have not revisited Aztec. I would have loved to. I've actually thought about it over the years, but I think I read Aztec somewhere in my late teens or early 20s when I was first starting to get really back, fall really back in love with reading, John. And I was reading stuff like The Pillars of the Earth and some of these big kind of sagas like that. And other big books like Tom Clancy's stuff we talked about. And I read this book, Aztec, and I went back and just sort of checked out what it, you know, sort of refreshed my memory on it. It's like an epic story that's kind of epistolary in nature. So it's like sort of told in these big long letters. It's basically the life story of this like warrior from like the Aztec tribe. And it's set in like what you mentioned, what we would call the Middle Ages before. It's set in like the 1500s in Mexico. But the, so it's the life story of this guy named Mixtli, like Mixtli. I think it's like Mixtli, his name translates into Mixtli Dark Cloud. like hyphenated Dark Cloud.
Okay.
And he's basically just this Aztec warrior, and he's telling his story, he's telling his story through a bishop, Catholic bishop, who has come to Mexico on behalf of King Carlos in Spain, who is trying to kind of, you know, take over the country on the behalf of the Catholic Church. So he sends this bishop, you know, and he's got his troops in there and stuff, and they're trying to, like, you know, put down all the native tribes and make it a Catholic country. So this bishop is relating the life story of this guy, Mixley Dark Cloud, back to King Carlos. So the bishop kind of writes an introduction to each chapter in which his disdain for the Aztecs and their way of life and their, like, sort of, you know, what's the word, savagery, is quite evident. But then the rest of the story is this guy, Mixley Dark Cloud, telling his story, his life story on his own. And it's this epic journey of, like, ridiculous violence, human sacrifices, tons of sex, you know, blood flowing from page to page. They're long. It's a little bit like Mel Gibson's Apocalypto, you know, like,
yeah,
like the, it's just blood soaked. And I don't remember episode to episode well in this book, and I'm going to cut it off, but man, it was a classic rip roaring adventure story that I admire people like, you know, Ken Follett and like Gary Jennings, who wrote several sequels before he died. And then it was like taken over by a conglomerate or whatever, and they kept putting books out. But Aztec is the original book. And I don't care how good literati wise these books are, there must have been a massive amount of research and industry that went into writing these books. And I just admire the crap out of that. So that's my first one. If anybody listening, you know, maybe doesn't want to really, like, you know, get into the geopolitics or, like, you know, very serious studies of Mexico or the language or the border or anything like that, but you want a rip-roaring story about Mexican history, you can't do much worse than Aztec by Gary Jennings. Go back and check it out. It's still in print, and it has a lot of admirers. So that's my first one.
Well, it's kind of cool, too, that, like, because one of the – I don't know that we've brought him up yet in one of our Read Around the World episodes, but we almost should have. He would be sort of a patron saint of kind of literature from different parts of the world in a way, although I don't think he has the best reputation necessarily as a writer. But that would be James Michener. And he, you know, wrote all these big, like you're talking about, these big fat novels about different parts of the world. They're always historical novels. And he wrote one called Mexico. That's this huge doorstop. I know that you're familiar with it. And that would be sort of like the, if you're like on a Jeopardy game and you're going to go for, you know, big fat historical epic novels from the 80s about Mexico, you would pick James Michener. You know, like that would be your immediate answer. But Gary Jennings maybe, you know, is not one that's as remembered. I kind of like that you started off with something that was a little bit obscure. Do you remember, by the way, like, did he write other books about other cultures or anything like that? Or do you remember anything else that he might have written or no?
So I remember vaguely, he was famous before Aztec in the 70s for another epic novel. I think it was called The Journeyer or The Journeyist or something like that. Something clunky, but having to do with a journey, and it was like an epic historical book, but I just don't know where that was set. But it was a big bestseller. But once he published Aztec, he came out with two or three sequels. One was called Aztec Moon. I think one was called Aztec Autumn. And I think that kind of became like his thing, you know. And I know, and I think they took a great deal of work, which is like, you know, what I think you would have to do for books like that. Like, I would defend Michener. I haven't read him in a while, but I've read some of his big epic books, like Chesapeake, for example, about the region you live in. Mm-hmm. And man, I mean, you know, there must be just tons and tons of work that goes into writing books like that. So anyway, yeah, I don't know if he wrote much more than the Aztec books.
Interesting. Well, that's a good start. So like I said, what I did, I have a number of just categories that I want to talk about, and I might cite either one to two, maybe even three, depending on the category, books that I would, you know, recommend or in that particular category. And I wanted to start by at least covering a couple famous writers from who are Mexican, from Mexico, kind of like, you know, some of the greatest literary voices from that region, most acclaimed, most well-known, most famous. And I don't, you know, like we always say about these episodes, we don't claim to be experts in any way. I am nowhere near an expert in Mexican literature or culture, not even close. And so there are many Mexican writers that I've never read, and it would be worthwhile to do so. But I wanted to at least mention a couple. One of these books I have read, the other writer, I'm pretty deficient in my knowledge of that particular writer, but I thought it would be worth bringing up. One of the most famous novels that you hear talked about again and again and again, and I know you have, Jude, but I don't think you've ever read it, and this is going to be your alarm bell to make sure that you read this. You were talking about making sure I read Paul Murray a little bit before. Well, someday you've got to read the book named Pedro Páramo, and it's by a Mexican writer named Juan Rulfo. I am going to venture to guess that you've heard of the book.
Well, John, let me throw you my second surprise of the night. Pedro Páramo was a surprise discovery for me at the library, so I read it in preparation for this episode.
Oh, nice. So very nice.
So I read it. So let it rip.
Well, that's okay. Then you'll remember it a lot more than I will. But I did. I read it too, but it's been a number of years. But this, in kind of reading around and doing a little bit of, you know, thin research for this episode, there are many writers, Mexican, Latin American, and otherwise, that would cite this as Mexico's greatest novel. As a matter of fact, no less than Jorge Luis Borges said about the book Pedro Páramo, that it's one of the greatest stories that's to come from any culture, you know, anywhere on the planet. And it was, as you probably know, it was an absolutely essential and formative read for Gabriel Garcia Marquez out of Colombia. Mm-hmm. It was the book that he himself credited that kind of broke open his famous book, 100 Years of Solitude. So you having read it recently, you're going to know more about it. You'll remember more about it, and you can probably correct what I have wrong here. That is one of the most famous, if not the most famous, you know, sort of quote unquote modern novel to come out of Mexico. And it has to do with a man who goes to visit his mother on her deathbed. And I'm sure I won't get some of these details right. And he promises, what does he promise you? That he's going to go find his father or go visit the hometown of his father.
I think it's both. Like so she asks him to go find him in his hometown,
right,
where he's been, and she wants him to kind of, she wants him to meet his dad and get him to kind of pay up for all the neglect that, you know, for all the years that he kind of neglected her and his son.
So was this on your list of books to discuss?
It was, but I knew it was on yours, and I stumbled by it on it by accident. So I want you to say your piece on it, and I promise I won't say a lot about it. I just mainly wanted to let you know that I remembered you saying that it needed to be read, and then I saw it, and I said, "Well, John said this needed to be read," so, and it was short, so I read it.
Well, and because I don't remember it that well, I won't have a ton to say on it. But I thought we could just sort of, if you don't mind, we could just sort of jointly discuss it now, briefly.
Sure.
But it's an extraordinary novel, and when he goes to this town, this village, to meet his father, I don't know if they've never met or they're certainly estranged. And essentially, he finds the village to be entirely populated by ghosts. And at this point, the novel takes on this sort of, you know, this is a cliche term, but kind of this magical realist sort of edge where he basically drifts around through this literal ghost town and encounters different ghosts who live there. One is a Catholic priest. There are women who are, you know, laborers and workers who live there. I don't remember everybody who lives there, but he sort of hears their stories. And the narrative jumps back and forth in time as well, because they're ghosts. They're just sort of in a kind of afterlife. And the rest of the novel is just kind of him, you know, talking to these various characters. But what it ends up being is this very kind of surreal, sort of dreamlike mosaic that has so much to say about Mexican culture and Mexican history that I'm no expert, but you can see why, both in its sort of like radical style and also its content, this is one of the richest books to come out of Mexico, because using this sort of technique or this device, you know, Rulfo is able to explore Mexican life and culture from all kinds of different historical periods. And it's just this kind of surreal, and it's very dark too. I know it has a really dark ending, which you probably remember. But it ends up being this kind of, sort of like tour through the history of Mexico through these characters who are just kind of, you know, salt of the earth characters who live in this village. And I don't remember a whole lot of the detail, but I do remember the impression that the book made on me. And it's uncompromising. It's original. It's fascinating. It's a real sort of amalgamation of all kinds of different characters. And it's just fascinating. It's just a really interesting novel. I don't know. What was your impression of it, having never read it until just recently?
Well, I'm feeling kind of ashamed because I read it two or three books ago now, and I'm trying to even remember all the details. Sometimes, books that go by fast, it's a short book.
Yeah.
I think you did a really good job of describing it, even after all this time. But obviously, it made an impression on you. And I think the same things, the same qualities you're talking about are what will stay with me, I think. I don't do very well remembering the plot details. I'm not even sure, John, I'll admit to the audience, that I really understood that all the characters were ghosts.
Yeah.
And sometimes, John, just as an aside, you know, a book makes an impression on you. 2 weeks later, you don't remember the plot, but like 15 years later, you do remember some of the plot. You know what I mean? So like, you know,
right.
Books have an interesting life. What I think you're really right about, and we can move on, is the kind of surreal richness of the book. It's very enigmatic. It's kind of dreamlike. It's a little confusing. It jumps around from not only from place to place in the village, but in time. And you get this feeling of, I don't even know, like mystery, sort of desolation, sadness, you know, echoes of past violence, abuse, you know, all these things are kind of worked into this strange dreamlike story that's just kind of surreal. It's sort of like to the one side of what, you know, you and I understand as reality. And it's just kind of you can really see, if you're somebody who admires people like Marquez or any kind of magical realist writer, Salman Rushdie, for example, or people who have taken his, you know, Marquez's lead and kind of run with it, you can see how this book was influential, although it's a much shorter book. And also it just gives you, exactly like you said, kind of a real feel for like the richness and the strangeness to us, and kind of the all these different dualities or conflicting aspects of Mexico.
Yeah, it's just a very surreal and unusual and weird book. But we should say that Pedro Paramo, the title character, is the father of the main character of the book. But
right,
the narrative kind of loops around on itself. I remember that because he's sort of like through all these characters, he learns about the history of this village, and it kind of takes you up to, you know, this like woman who ends up, you know, asking her son on her deathbed to go visit her, you know, to go find his father. So it kind of loops around on itself. And I believe, right. I think that the main character is like brutally murdered sorry for the spoiler, you know, like in the last few pages of it. So it's just, it's a really dark and sort of surreal, you know, slice of Mexican history and culture. But like you said, it's short. It was hugely influential for that country and anybody, you know, interested in Mexican literary, you know, tradition or history at all. It, you really can't miss it. So
yeah, I think what you just said is spot on post. Like, you know, if you want to get in any kind of taste of Mexican literature or like the history of Mexican literature specifically, as opposed to other art forms, you can't miss Pedro Páramo.
That's right. So the other Mexican writer, and I will do quickly because I haven't read much of him at all, but one of the most famous Mexican writers, maybe the most famous, besides maybe Juan Rulfo, of the 20th century, bleeding into the 21st, would be Carlos Fuentes. Now, I brought him up at the end of our last episode because I said I was going to read one of his books in preparation for this episode. But I get the Jackass of the Episode Award. I then went back and realized I had indeed already read the book that I was talking about, which is called Old Gringo. It's one of the books by Carlos Fuentes. And it kind of, the historical facts of the matter are that the American writer in the Civil War period, roughly, named Ambrose Bierce, escaped to Mexico because he wanted to help with one of the many Mexican revolutions. Mexicans were trying to overthrow sort of the corrupt government and achieve independence. And in this time setting, they may have been trying to achieve independence from the United States, but I'm not entirely sure about that. But anyway, Ambrose Bierce went down to kind of fight for Mexican freedom, basically, and he disappeared there. So Carlos Fuentes, the Mexican writer, wrote a novel kind of imagining what the end of his life might have been like. Now, unfortunately, as I found out, I've already read it years ago, but I didn't remember much of it. So I guess it didn't make that much of an impression on me at the time. But Carlos Fuentes is one of the most famous Mexican writers. He's got many famous books, one of which is called, the most famous, arguably, is called The Death of Artemio Cruz, I think is the name of the book. He's got another big novel called Terra Nostra. He's got another big novel about Mexican history and, you know, kind of the revolution that happened in the early part of the 20th century. It's called Where the Air is Clear. So Carlos Fuentes has written a number. He was nominated for the Nobel Prize. He's one of the most prominent and well-known novelists. He's deceased now, but who came out of Mexico. So I feel like we have to bring him up. I've only read the one book by him. I don't remember it very well. But some of those other, I have the novel Where the Air is Clear on my shelves, and I wouldn't mind reading that, especially now that I've learned a little bit more about Mexican history, because that has to do with Mexican history in the 20th century, which is, that's very vague, but I know it's kind of like situated in 20th century Mexican history. But anyway, Carlos Fuentes, another novel that even though, another writer that even though I can't really recommend a specific novel from him that made a huge impact on me, he's a writer that if you want to read one of the famous writers from Mexico, you have to at least look at his body of work. Jude, I don't think you've ever read anything from Carlos Fuentes, have you?
No, I think I might. Is there a runner-up to the Jackass of the Episode Award? Because I have never read Carlos Fuentes. I've certainly come across him many times over many years, but I have never read anything by him that I can remember. You know, like I don't think so. I've had experiences like the one you talked about where you don't even remember that you read a book, you know. But anyway, I don't think I've read Carlos Fuentes. Certainly heard of him, and I would have to think of it as an oversight, you know.
Yeah, well, you and I both need to get on that. But that's another one I wanted. You know, we have to, and we're going to talk about some more contemporary Mexican writers in a while here. I know we're going to bring up some that are alive now and writing. But maybe that brings us up to what is your second book that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Well, There's one book that I really felt like I had to mention that I read. Although it's not entirely about Mexico. It's this massive, and I have to say, I don't know many people that would read this book, but it's a book that was published early in this millennium. It's a massive, over 900 page, at least in English, novel by the name of 2666. And that was written by a South American writer named Roberto Bolaño. It was his last novel before he died of, I think it was liver cancer, some form of cancer. And it was published in like around 2004, 2005 in the United States. I don't even know how I would describe this book, 2666. It made a huge splash around the world and was very famous at the time it was published as being his last novel, which he wrote while he was dying and having such a gargantuan size and scope to it. It's not really about Mexico. It's per se. But, well, I should say the book is divided into five sections, and the sections have different titles. Like, one is called The Part About the Critics. One is called The Part About a Character Named El Malfitano, who is a professor of philosophy from Chile. There's a part that's set in Harlem in New York City called The Part About Fate, which has to do with this Mexican journalist who's sent to cover a boxing match. There's a part called The Part About another character who is a literary novelist, much like Roberto Bolaño. Another part discusses a literary conference of critics in Europe. But the major portion of the book is called The Part About Fate, and it's this gigantic section in the middle of the story that's set in Juarez, Mexico, and chronicles the murders of something like 150 or 60 young women in Juarez, Mexico that happened, I think, late in the 20th century, and the police that are trying to solve this massive amount of murders of young women in Mexico. And it's this huge portion of the book that details all these murders in like the CSI kind of forensic style, and it goes on forever, just covering murder after murder after murder after murder, describing like the position of the young woman and where she was found and who was in her family and the last people that saw her and stuff like that. And it does this for like tens and tens and almost hundreds of different murder victims in the book, and it has this insanely powerful and kind of oppressive, accumulative effect on the reader in the middle of this sprawling novel about literature, about critics of literature, about this Mexican journalist. I don't even know how I would really describe it further past that, John. It's just that the book, I was so curious to discover this book and see what it was about. The book, you know, again, I'm kind of really impressed by books that take a massive amount of effort and work to kind of produce an imagination. I have absolutely no idea how even a perfectly healthy novelist would have written a book like this, let alone somebody who was dying of cancer and sort of racing to get it done, as Bolaño was. I don't know what all these parts of this book amount to. I don't know if I would even recommend it to like a general reader. What I can say is, that piece of Mexican, and it was actually historical. Like, it was based on a big series of murders in Juarez, Mexico, of young women that nobody ever figured out why somebody was killing all the young women in Juarez, Mexico. That the power of that section has kind of, I guess I would use the word haunted me ever since I read the book. So I don't want to say more because of the time factor, and I don't know who would read it. But it's just, it's kind of unforgettable. I don't know. I don't know if you have, I know you haven't read it. Do you have any thoughts about it?
Well, I have a thought sort of connected to it, which is that it's fascinating that that huge middle section of that book is about that. Because I have a memory from being, weirdly enough, newly married, which would situate in terms of the calendar or the time frame, that would be the early 90s. And I remember seeing a, I don't know if it was 60 Minutes or like 48 Hours or a news program. This is, I remember because I was watching a news program at night and didn't have any children. So, you know, that's a strange place to be when you have multiple children, thinking about that. But, and there was a whole report on what they called the Lost Girls of Juarez. And it was my first exposure in any way to what was going on there at that time. So I have this very distinct memory of just being absolutely like blown away by this news story that was detailing all these young girls and women that were going missing in like the desert around Juarez and around the border, because Juarez City is right across from El Paso, across the river, across the border, separating Mexico and Texas. So I was just transfixed by this report. I just could not believe that so many young women were going missing. And so, you know, I vividly remember that. And so this part of this book that you're talking about, 2666, is based on that, you know. So that's, it's strange to think that, you know, there's this big section of this big sort of epic, you know, famous novel that deals with the same exact historical, you know, reality that I was sort of transfixed by back in the late 90s. So that's pretty wild. But I'm, you know, I remember just thinking like all these young lives going missing and no one's going to ever remember them. So in a weird way, at least, you know, I give credit to, Bolaño for keeping that story alive, you know, as part of this bigger novel. So,
well, that's a very good point. And the other thing point I wanted to make about it before we move on is that, so Bolaño died. Great point you just made about, you know, sort of somehow sustaining the memory of all these people, these young women whose lives were lost through this kind of magnificent but very mysterious work of art. But there's a great, and I just use the word mysterious, there's a great mysterious factor to the novel, to include the title. And so, like I was just saying, Bolaño died, and he never explained where the title came from, but there's a legend or a sort of a myth that the distance of time between the creation of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Good and Evil by God and the Great Flood that with like Noah and the Ark was 2,666 years. And somehow people connect that legend with him titling that goes beyond me, but that speaks to the great mystery around this story. Like, the whole story we know was inspired by these murders, but then it kind of weirdly spread outward like this, like, oil slick or something into all these different areas. We can leave it at that, but it's just, because like I said, I don't know many people that would read it. But if you do, you wouldn't forget about it.
Yeah, man, that's wild. That really, that's an interesting pick, and I'm glad we got it in here. Hey, I meant to mention, let me see here, a little time check. We got a little time before we should take a break. I meant to mention this before. We were talking about Pedro Páramo. I just like literally stumbled across this, but apparently it's being shot as an adaptation that's going to be on Netflix. Pedro Páramo, believe it or not, like a Spanish language movie adaptation is coming, which is pretty wild.
Yeah, that is, man.
But anyway, the guy that somewhere on a blog, I saw that, and the author of this blog post that talks about that, he says anybody who reads Pedro Páramo is entranced by it. It's a perfect book, a slippery, melancholy, uncanny thing that can be read in an afternoon, but will linger like the ghosts of Kamala. That might be the name of the village, like the ghosts of Kamala long after its end. Yes. So that's just another little intriguing plug for Pedro Páramo.
Yeah, anyway, yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what, you know, what comes out of that. So, yeah, that's a great one, 2666, much more contemporary. I'm going to go back a little bit, Jude. I feel like there are some, you know, what we would call in the West, this is where it gets kind of tricky, because I'm going to, in a little bit of a speed round, I want to bring up some quote unquote classics of literature that a lot of people, if they haven't read, would at least have heard of, that I have read and I believe need to be part of this discussion, but they're all written by basically, you know, white Western writers who either set their stories in Mexico or happened to travel to Mexico themselves and set a novel there. So in the latter category, one of the first novels that I thought of was this famous book that was written by a British writer named Malcolm Lowry. It's called Under the Volcano.
Yeah.
And it's this long, epic, really challenging and interesting and, you know, sort of incandescent novel about a man, sort of a British, he might be working for the consulate down there. And he's living and working in Mexico, but he's sort of on this epic bender, basically. You know, he's experiencing a lot of despair and hopelessness. His marriage is falling apart. And in the, it's basically this huge book about somebody who's trying to drink themselves to death. But it's set in Mexico, and it's also famously, you know, the action of it takes place over a number of days that correspond with the celebrations around what's called, you know, Dios de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead, which is a famous, very, very popular celebration and cultural event in Mexico that happens, you know, around the 1st of November. It's often portrayed in movies, you know, like the Bond film where there's like an action sequence in the middle of Day of the Dead, you know, like, or there's been at least a couple animated movies about the Day of the Dead in Mexico, like Coco or that movie Book of Life, etc. So, but I kind of feel like that story, even though it's memorably set in Mexico and very memorably written, and it's kind of like reading that book novel is like being on your own bender. It's really surreal and, oh man, it's nuts. It's like being like on a drug trip or something. And it's a very famous book, but I feel like, well, it just happens to be set in Mexico. It's not really about Mexico. You know, I mean, it is. It gets into a lot of Mexican traditions and sort of cultural aspects, but it's written from the point of view of a British guy. You know what I mean? So, like, I feel like it's worth mentioning, but it's not really about Mexico or Mexican history, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I agree on all counts. I really love the word you use, John. I compliment you. Incandescent is a very good way to describe it.
But yeah, it's definitely you read it, right?
I did it, and I really struggled with that book. You recommended it to me. I thought it was a very difficult book, both from the point of view of
it is
readability, but also just desirability in terms of wanting to hang out. And that's the whole thing. You're in. It's a book that's like really immersed in this in this one man, white British man's despair, essentially. You know. So, but at the same time, it's like you think of it as kind of a Mexican, you're south of the border novel. So it's like I totally understand why you brought it up.
Yeah, and there's another one. So, and I remember, again, sorry, spoiler alert, but like at the end of this really long kind of like difficult novel where he's going through, you know, he's awful to his wife. There's a whole chapter where they're just arguing with each other for the whole chapter. And, you know, it's really, it's a challenge, but you get to the very end of it and he's basically shot, murdered, and like thrown into a ditch. You know, like that's the end, the end of the.
It's comparable to the, this is a tangent, but it's comparable to the book, The Heart of the Matter by Graham Greene in some ways, you know, even though that's set in Africa.
Yeah, it is. I'm going to, and he's going to come up in a minute or two here, but,
yeah, I knew that. So if people are familiar with that book, but.
Well, there's another one I just want to bring up quickly, and it's called Tristessa. It's by Jack Kerouac. You and I have talked on the show about how we kind of went through a Kerouac phase.
Oh, yeah.
And we were sort of like in our 20s, like a lot of people do, especially like American white guys. I hate to say it.
No, it's true. Yeah.
So, but Tristessa is a really kind of memorable, it's a very slim novel. I really liked it, but it's based on travels that Jack Kerouac made down to Mexico City. It's kind of loosely, very thinly veiled personal account of going down there and sort of falling in love with a prostitute in like a seedy part of Mexico City. And it's beautifully written. Tristessa means sadness, has these other layers to it. You know, it's very poetic. But I just mentioned it because I really liked the book at the time. But it's not about Mexico. It's about Kerouac. Just like, you know, Under the Volcano isn't really about Mexico. It's about Malcolm Lowry, you know?
Yeah, it's like sort of like, let me borrow your country to go on my bender, you know?
Yeah, so I acknowledge that it's a little bit problematic in a way bringing these books up, but they are very memorable books, these novels. So there's two other classics that I wanted to quickly bring up. One is, you and I have talked about it on the show before. Graham Greene, you just brought him up, is an amazing writer. Maybe his greatest novel ever is The Power and the Glory. Mm-hmm. Now, that is set in Mexico, but it is also about Mexican history. And mm-hmm. people may not realize there's a complimentary book, a nonfiction book that Graham Greene wrote, which is kind of based on the research he was doing while he was writing The Power and the Glory, and it's called The Lawless Roads. And I've read both. And if you pairing those together, you know, The Power and the Glory is the story of a famously nameless priest called the Whiskey Priest, who, you know, basically Catholicism and priests have been, you know, banned by the government. And they're going around and basically murdering priests who continue to practice. And this Whiskey Priest is just a disaster of a person. He's a drunk, obviously. He's fathered an illegitimate child. But he refuses to give up his practice. And he goes from village to village. And he kind of, even in his sort of moral decrepitude, you know, he delivers the Eucharist. He administers to these communities. And they sort of love him for it. And eventually it leads to this sort of confrontation between him and officials of the government, who drag him into a town square and, you know, are going to execute him. And he remains true to his Catholic faith, you know, to the bitter end. And it's just an incredibly powerful, beautiful, beautifully written novel. And The Lawless Roads is a book about Graham Greene's travels through Mexico. And this was during a time when the Catholic Church was being persecuted there. And you can sort of understand why, because the Catholic Church has this very long and notorious history, basically forcing indigenous Mexican people to convert and take on their religion, which was very successful for hundreds of years. But eventually the pendulum, you know, swung the other way. But Graham Greene was, you know, on the ground researching this and while he was writing this novel. And my point is, these two books together form a very powerful portrayal of the country of Mexico in a time of great turmoil. And they also reveal, maybe more than even intended, you know, how important Graham Greene's Catholicism and Catholic faith was to him, even though he struggled with it for most of his life. So those two novels are that novel and that nonfiction book together are a high recommendation from me. And then, sorry to go on, Jude, but then lastly,
go ahead.
There's a very short novella, beautiful book by John Steinbeck. His most famous novella by far is Of Mice and Men, which is, in my opinion, a perfect book. Mm. But he has a number of short novellas that I think are all beautiful. Of Mice and Men is the crown jewel. The Red Pony is a beautiful book. And there's one called The Pearl. I'm trying to remember. I don't think you've read The Pearl, have you?
No, I'm a huge John Steinbeck person, but I have never read The Pearl, never.
Okay. Just so you know, you're sounding a little bit quieter, so I don't know if there's any way you can I don't know if you've moved away from the phone or not, but just.
No, but I'll try to jack it up a little.
Okay, it may not come through on the recording, but The Pearl is another one I have to recommend. And it's basically, it's based on a Mexican folktale. The book's about 90 pages. It's about a very poor Mexican family that live on the beach on the western side of Mexico, so on the Baja Peninsula side. And they basically make their living by, he's a very, very poor fisherman, but he tries to, every day he goes out in this very ramshackle boat that's kind of like, he learned, it's like an indigenous style of boat. And the novella makes pains to say that, you know, this way of making boats in this way is just long lost. But he has this boat, he takes it out, he dives to the bottom of the ocean, he is looking for pearls, and he finds, he's destitute, he has a new baby, the baby's sick, he needs to pay money to get the baby to even be looked at by the local doctor, who's like a, you know, a European, who won't even help them. But then he just miraculously finds like the mother of all pearls, this like perfect pearl that's like the size of an egg, like an egg from a bird. And then all of a sudden everybody wants a piece of this guy. The doctor's willing to see him. And, you know, it's sort of this fable about how, unlike the gospel story where, like, you know, you find the pearl of great price and of great, oh gosh, I'm blanking on the name.
Well, is that the pearl of great price? Or
yeah, sorry, the pearl of great price, and you sell everything you have to buy the field so you can keep the pearl. In this story, the pearl is what causes all these bad things to happen in the life of this poor fisherman. And it goes on from there. But it's just this exquisite little fable that has to do with greed and, you know, kind of universal themes like that. But it's all set in Mexico. And one of the things that, and I'll stop after this, but I think you need to read it because you love Steinbeck, but it's you can see that he's immersed himself in some of the mythology and the myths and the fairy tales around indigenous Mexican culture, and he kind of brings those in and weaves them into the novel in a really beautiful way. And it's just this, it's like the pearl, it's like this perfect little jewel of a story that has kind of a tragic ending, but I think you'd really love it. So it has to be one of my recommendations for this list.
Yeah, I think that, you know, you can, I've never read it, but you can tell why that would make an impression on you. And you can, in the case of that book, because all these books are kind of written by sort of outsiders, but in the case of that book, again, not having read it, you can see how, like, maybe the spirit of the place or the beauty of the place kind of got into the, under the skin of the writer and sort of inspired him to write a fable like that, that was, ended up being applicable outward to kind of almost any society.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Like you can see that he was enamored with and respected the indigenous culture there, you know, that preceded the European culture that was in Mexico, that came to Mexico. So anyway, it's a really interesting example of writing from Steinbeck. I can't really think of anything that's maybe some of his early sort of mystical stuff, but I can't really think of anything else that he wrote that I'm familiar with that is quite like it. So anyway, should we take a break and then come back and then you can talk about your third book?
Yeah, I think that's a good plan.
Okay, let's do it.
All right.
All right, Jude, we're back. And now I'm turning it over to you again. What is another recommendation you have?
Well, I'm excited about this one, John. I'm going to talk for a little bit about a novel that you gifted me in the book exchange that gives the podcast its name.
Nice.
Fairly recently. And I'm going to do it as a kind of a segue into the next writer I'm going to talk about, but I'll, you know, we'll go back and forth. But I thought I'd hit this one first because This book is a kind of a reissue of a book that came out in the middle of the 20th century, wasn't as well known, and it was sort of retranslated and then published with an introduction from a contemporary Mexican novelist that I want to talk about a little later. And I think that you could probably join in with me on that. But anyway, the book I want to mention now is published in 1947. This, I'll just say it now, John, I don't think I've said this yet. This is one of my favorite books of the year, easily.
Nice.
It's gonna show up on my top 10 list, no question. It's just a matter of where it places. It's called His Name Was Death, and it was published by a Mexican writer named Rafael Bernal that I had never heard of before, somebody that lived in the 20th century, born in 1915 and died in 1972, and had like a number of other works that were kind of like noirish stories. But then he wrote this kind of really unique precursor to eco fiction, kind of a blazing brief novel, blazing page turner, kind of a thriller, kind of a crazy surrealistic book all in one piece. I absolutely love this book. It brilliantly translated. Not that I know anything about translation, but I'm going to read a short passage in a minute that shows you kind of the quality of the writing in this particular book. But man, I don't even know where to, you know, this is a crazy story. So it's about this, like, I think it's a white guy. Forgive me for my bad memory. I'm pretty sure it's a white guy again who's in Mexico, and he's like a drunk. And he decides to kind of forsake civilization, so he goes into the Mexican jungle to kind of like drink himself to death, you know, which I don't know why anybody would do that, but this gets,
as
this
he guy, did. Yeah.
You know, as one does, I guess, when they're like a big drunk.
Right.
But, but so he does that, and he's trying to drink himself to death, and he gets discovered by this like shaman, this like, you know, kind of like priest sort of shaman figure from like a Mexican tribe out there in the jungle, way deep in the jungle.
Sure.
Who goes by the name of Black Ant. And this shaman kind of takes him in and sees what he's trying to do and sort of nurses him back to health and gives him all these, like, cures. And in the process of giving him these cures, he, like, banishes the demon of alcoholism from this guy who I think is, like, a professor, you know, by trade. And so this professor has been, you know, the demon of alcoholism has been banished from this professor. And as he's recovering, he's, like, plagued by these mosquitoes. And slowly, and this is where the book just kind of takes a turn for the wild. Slowly, he's gradually recuperating, so he has nothing but time, and he's just surrounded by these mosquitoes all the time. So he begins to kind of discern patterns in the way that they buzz between each other. And long story short, he develops a way between his own ear and like this kind of this flute that he gets from one of the tribe members to figure out the language of the mosquitoes, and then start communicating with the mosquitoes. And he's like the first person in human history who's just figured out how to communicate with these mosquitoes. And once he does that, he discovers that they're very intelligent and extremely pissed off and staging these plans to take over the world from the humans, you know? And from there, it becomes this crazy. It's a very fast-moving story with short chapters in which they kind of elevate this man who's learned to communicate with them to kind of like a godlike figure, and he's going to lead them, give them the necessary means to launch their attack on the rest of human civilization to take over the planet. And it just goes from there, and it's like this crazy, surreal, tragicomic story that you just have no idea where it's going to zig and zag. And I thought it was just totally riveting, but also really thought-provoking. And I'm just going to, just by way of wrapping up, I'm going to just read a short passage. There's not much context to it. Oh, I'm beginning to hear an echo. Can you hear an echo?
I heard that, but it was... Well, now I hear it from me.
All right. Well, I'll keep
just
going.
Keep going, yeah.
Anyway, this is late in the book, and it's first-person narration,
and the person who says, I,
yeah, yeah, I'm getting a bad echo, but I'll just keep going, is the professor in question who has been kind of recruited by this mosquitoes after learning their language. And I'll just read a quick paragraph. It'll just show you the kind of writing that's in this book and the kind of thought-provoking inquiries that are in this novel. It says, I waited for them to return to the Caraball. I don't know what that means. Thinking about death. Even in the most remote places, people tend to shroud it with so much ceremony, always hoping to take away its power. But in the world to come, in the mosquito's new world, human death would take on about the same importance as the death of cattle in our city slaughterhouses that our city slaughterhouses have today. In my opinion, this would remedy many of humanity's ills, such as pain and mourning. I do believe the image of Miss Jones, which is somebody he was in love with her face covered, convulsing in tears, leaning on the professor's arm, treading weakly over the earth, moved me. And yet, I already knew that all great works require pain, that all real changes in the world, every change that has led to good, such as Christianity, has laid its foundations upon blood and suffering. But was the change I had in mind actually going to lead to good? So there's just an example from the book. You still there?
Yeah.
Okay. I just found this book to be kind of riveting, really mysterious. It moved like lightning. It kind of had environmental aspects. It had some religious aspects, as you heard there, and just existential stuff. And it was just wildly, wildly original. I can't recommend it enough. So that's the next one on my list. It's called His Name Was Death.
Listen, I gave it to you. I thought it sounded fascinating. It sounds awesome to me. Just really weird and different and original, and yet also touching on different aspects of, as you've just said, like sort of Mexican history, culture, maybe indigenous culture. You know, it sounds like a potent mix to me. And also, he has one other book in translation that was put out by the same publisher. And I know this because I was like, you can hear me, right?
Yes,
I can. I was like debating between this one I'm about to mention and the one that I gave to you, which was His Name Was Death. But it's called The Mongolian Conspiracy. And it's basically, it sounds like it's sort of like a hard-boiled, like, noir detective tale that takes place in Mexico City in, like, the middle of the 20th century. And that's really all I know, but it sounds really cool and very different from what you just described. So that might be another one. You know, it's kind of a good segue for me, actually, because I was about to recommend some kind of quote-unquote genre picks coming out of Mexico, you know, but that would be one of them, kind of a detective story. If you're somebody who really gets into like noir detective type stories, you might want to go check out Rafael. I think it's Rafael Bernal is the name of the writer, right?
That's right.
And New Directions Publishing put out both His Name Is Death and The Mongolian Conspiracy. You should, if you haven't, you should go read the description for that book because it sounds really fun. But, okay, anyway, like I just said, I'm going to do kind of a quick round here. And because I mentioned in the beginning, I haven't really stuck to it that well, but like kind of different categories I was going to talk about and kind of make at least one recommendation. And that's what I'm going to do here. I've got a comic novel, I've got a crime novel, and I've got a horror novel that either come out of Mexico or were set in Mexico. So the horror novel is one called The Ruins by Scott Smith, and you'll recognize that title, I'm sure. Yes. And I never read the book. I'll admit that flat out, but I have seen the movie. But, you know, I just wanted to throw this in here. I wanted to make sure that we had different types of books for different types of readers. If you're a horror person or you like something like Stephen King, this is supposedly a quite gory and kind of fun novel, horror novel set in Mexico. It's basically about these two young couples who go on one of these adventure excursions down to the Mexican jungle. They're visiting different, you know, archaeological sites from the Mayans and the Aztecs and whatnot. And they come across a an old temple, kind of like one of these pyramids out in the middle of the jungle. You know, they have a guide that leads them there. They get separated from the guide. One of the four gets sort of lost in the innards of the temple, and they have to go in after them, and then all kinds of, you know, they discover some kind of evil presence there, and all, you know, mayhem and bloodshed ensue, basically. It's like tourism horror, you know, in a way. I can't really vouch for how good a book this is or how well written. But again, if you like if you're into horror novels, this is one that's set in Mexico. I saw the movie. It's okay. But, you know, it's kind of interesting and fun because it's set, the whole setting and the milieu that you're sort of dealing with is ancient, you know, Aztec ruins way out in the middle of nowhere in Mexico. I would read it. Sounds kind of fun to me, but I never have read it. Have you?
No, I've certainly heard of it. I remember hearing about it before it was a movie, and then I've heard of the movie, but I'd read it.
It's a great idea. Either. So that's I put that out there for someone who might be interested in that. If you're a crime novel person, there's one writer right now who's written a series of books, or at least two. And, you know, we're probably not going to cover this as much as we could, but there's a whole other side to, you know, contemporary Mexican history that, of course, has to do with the drug trade and the various drug cartels that have caused so much misery and violence and bloodshed in the country of Mexico. And there are many of them. You know, many people know about them from, you know, TV shows and movies like Sicario or Narcos, that series, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a writer, an American writer named Don Winslow, who's written at least two books that are crime novels that are about kind of the operations of these various drug cartels in Mexico and the law enforcement people who are trying to stop what they're doing. One is called The Power of the Dog, and that was followed by a sequel, which is called brilliantly The Cartel. But The Power of the Dog is one that you gave me, and it's, you know, it's a classic crime novel. It's like, it's basically the modern equivalent of like something like, Clear and Present Danger or, Patriot Games, you know, those Clancy novels of sort of espionage and action thrillers that often involve terrorists and whatnot. These stories are fast moving. They're bloody. They get into a lot of the, you know, moral compromises that are made by law enforcement officials and policemen and agents, et cetera, as they're trying to contend with these horrible drug cartel henchmen and leaders, et cetera. So those are kind of, you know, I wasn't like totally blown away by The Power of the Dog by Don Winslow, but, you know, a lot of people were. A lot of people think they're, like, really gripping crime novels. And if you're a crime novel person, or, and that's, you know, you enjoyed a show like Narcos, you know, that would be a solid recommendation for kind of contemporary crime novels set in Mexico. So those are the books by Don Winslow. And then there's another novel that I'm calling a comic novel. This is a little bit more obscure and kind of off the beaten track, but there's a writer, American writer, that a lot of people love, though many people have never really heard of, named Charles Portis. He's probably best known for having written the novel True Grit, which was made into a movie twice. One starring John Wayne, the more modern adaptation was by the Coen brothers, starring Jeff Bridges. And that's a great book and a great movie. At least the Coen brothers version is great. But he wrote a book called Gringos, which is about an American living down in Mexico who's kind of he's been living there for a long time. He's sort of he's kind of a wanderer. He's sort of a peddler. He has sort of an interesting background, but he sort of ended up down living in a region of Mexico, near the Yucatan Peninsula. And he kind of, what he does is go to like ancient archaeological sites and tries to find, you know, hidden treasure, essentially. He's sort of a treasure hunter. But Gringos is a novel about this guy who's just kind of minding his own business down there. And it's really weird. It's a really weird kind of shaggy novel. There's a woman who he used to know from his past who ends up down there, and she's down there with his husband, with her husband. And this husband is convinced that there are like UFO landing sites in the jungles of Mexico. So he goes out and he tries to like find some of these sites, and of course he gets lost. So this guy, the main character, whose name is Jimmy Burns, who's like cobbling a living together in this village in Mexico, basically by ransacking like archaeological digs and other sites, agrees to help his old girlfriend to find her husband. But they also stumble upon this like sort of hippie commune that's down there. That's called the City of Dawn. And there's this like, it's led by this guy who calls himself a wizard named El Mago. You know, like it's just, it's alien, you know, theories. It's archaeological sites in ancient Mexico. It's hippie communes. It's potentially like blood sacrifices. It's this weird mix of like comedy and like Mexican ancient history. And it's just this very strange sort of shaggy novel. I use the word shaggy because it's just, it doesn't all go here really, but it's funny. It's weird. And Charles Portis was a really talented writer who had just kind of an interesting, quirky sense of humor. And if you enjoyed the movie or the novel True Grit, I think you'd really like this one. It's very strange, Jude, but if you saw it for like $2 at a used bookstore or something, you could do a lot worse than pick up Gringos by Charles Portis. It's like this weird, it's a little bit like Walker Percy. In that it's funny, but it also touches on kind of bigger questions and themes. And I really loved it. I think Charles Portis is kind of this under-the-radar novelist in 20th century America. And I think you'd really enjoy it, too. So that's Gringos by Charles Portis.
Cool. Are you done for now?
Yeah.
Okay, so, well, Charles Portis, I mean, I've always heard, I've never read him, and I've never read, you know, I've never read him, so I've never read True Grit or Gringos, but I've always heard really good things about the quality of his writing. Like, True Grit is one of those books that, like, you know, because I've seen the movie from the Coen Brothers a bunch of times, I've seen the John Wayne movie, and you feel like you know the story, but if you saw the book cheap, you'd buy it anyway because of the reputation of the book.
Oh, it's so,
you know?
The book is so good. I love the book. It's better than either of the movies.
Yeah, well, you know, there you go.
Yeah.
Because the movies are good, and then so the Gringos I check out. By the way, I want to make a little correction or more of an amendment to something you were saying about the Don Winslow novels, because I remember buying you the book, The Power of the Dog, and I remember you didn't love it that much, although I get that because a lot of straight-up crime novels that are really, really acclaimed, I don't have a lot of experience reading them, but I often find them kind of, you know, serviceable. You know,
yeah.
So I think, you know, they're just, some people are just big fans of that particular kind of story, you know, but from a writing perspective, they're usually just kind of, you know, workmanlike.
Right.
So I remember it didn't blow you out of the water, but that Don Winslow series is actually a trilogy. And it was funny that you said, you know, brilliant. The second book was brilliantly titled The Cartel, because the third book was even more brilliantly titled The Border. So, but there are great champions of Don Winslow, though.
Yeah.
And that trilogy in particular.
Definitely.
But it actually is a trilogy for people who, you know, care to know that. You know, there are three books.
You're right. Those books in a lot of circles are highly acclaimed. I thought the writing was, like, decent. But a lot of people love those books.
Definitely, yeah. And he has other books that people, you know, go nuts about. But anyway. So I want to ask you, just sort of production on the fly here. Can I do the following? I have two books. Well, one book and then one writer that I want to talk about. A couple different books by this writer left on my list. I think we're doing pretty good timing wise, at least from where I'm sitting. Can I bring up one book as a kind of an add-in to the category you just discussed? You know, sort of like a genre type of book, and I'll mention quickly, and then sort of segue into my last selection. Would that be okay?
Yeah, definitely. Yep, that works.
Okay, so to me it makes sense to throw this next book into the category John was just discussing, like the different genres, because there was a very buzzy book a couple of years back, around 2020, that I was interested to read for this episode, which I did, because I had come across it a couple different ways. I think you had too, John. It had a lot of advocates. It was a big buzzy book for a while. The book was called Mexican Gothic, and it was written by a young woman writer by the name of Silvia Moreno Garcia. And I wanted to kind of bring it up and talk about it really quickly. And it was, you know, the book is called Mexican Gothic, so I thought it would be kind of a, you know, it is kind of a gothic novel written in the tradition of stuff like Northanger Abbey and other gothic titles, maybe like, what's the famous, you know, Heathcliff and what the heck?
Wuthering Heights.
Famous, thank you, Wuthering Heights, stuff like that. But it's kind of a genre book, sort of almost has tinges of horror, and it was very popular and very well acclaimed a couple years ago. So I was curious to read it as a kind of a contemporary selection for this particular episode. And it's also the only book, with the exception of one that I might bring up at the end, that's written by a woman. I just haven't read that many Mexican books by women, or books set in Mexico by women. I wish I had. But, John, unfortunately, I did not like Mexican Gothic very much. I thought it was, I was not very impressed by it. I thought it was kind of a, how do I want to say it? Sort of a serviceable, kind of marginal story. It was set in Mexico. Didn't have much to say about Mexico. It was kind of about it was all about this young woman in the story who's called to a kind of a creepy mansion in the Mexican jungle or like mountains to kind of rescue her sister who has married this strange, enigmatic, rich white man from England who is kind of running this business in Mexico. And she, at the beginning of the book, the main character's sister sends a novel to the main character and her father, sends a letter to the main character and her father saying that she's trapped in the house and that there are ghosts there and there are weird things going on and can somebody come and help her before it's too late. So this young woman sets out at the request of her father to kind of go to this creepy mansion in the Mexican countryside and sort of assess what's going on and see if she can help her sister and maybe extricate her from a dangerous situation if there is one. And it turns into this kind of genre-ish story with a creepy secret in the house and ghosts in the house and this sort of like overbearing and instantly unlikable older woman who's like the housekeeper who takes an instant dislike to the main character. I didn't really like the book. I'm not really knocking on what I'm about to say, but this is a story written by a young woman about a very plucky young woman. And it's set in the 50s in Mexico. And this woman, the protagonist of the story, is not the type of girl who wants to be told what to do. And she's trying to sort of like bring herself forward into sort of modernity and fight against the sexism and stereotypes of the time and expectations of what she's supposed to do and be. I can totally understand why the young woman who wrote this book was excited by the character and wanted to write about a woman like that. I could see why young female readers or female readers would enjoy a story like that. I just didn't think the book was that original or interesting. I don't mind that she wrote about a plucky young woman. And it was interesting to you know, get in the mind of somebody who was kind of, you know, trying to fight against the limitations and the expectations put around her. But I thought the book kind of devolved into kind of cliche. Wasn't that interesting? I didn't really like it that much. So I have to unfortunately say that about Mexican Gothic. I don't know if there's anything you want to add, but I know you had heard of the book.
Yeah, I had. It's like you said, it's very buzzy, and it's just kind of interesting. Like sometimes it feels like the fact that it, you know, has to do with this plucky young female protagonist that's kind of pushing against the conventions of her time. Sometimes something like that feels like it can kind of cover a multitude of sins, you know, like, and I haven't read the book, so I, you know, it's just like, that's why the book is being noticed rather than its writing or its literary merit or its originality. Frankly, you know, that's often what happens, but, that's what it sounds like to me, but I can't really say that for sure because I haven't read it, but anyway.
Well, you're not surprised that it was like a big buzz in the publishing world in this day and age.
Uh-huh.
At the same time, though, I would have to say this, like I said, I understand why it was interesting to the person who wrote it, and more power to her. And also, I was impressed by how the book was structured in short chapters and moved very rapidly and was very readable, and you kept turning the pages. I like that part about it. I'm impressed by that.
Yeah.
But in the end, I just didn't feel it. I thought it was sort of silly. And then there were other instances, like there was one instance where the two sisters are talking. And this is the kind of thing that really takes a book. It seems like such a nitpick, but it's like, it takes the book and kind of like lowers the credibility of it by like several notches. So these two women are talking. They're in Mexico, the deep jungles of Mexico in the 1950s. And one of the women said, one of the sisters says something to the other, and the other woman, the other sister responds by saying, as if, which is a phrase that I don't think people said in the 1950s. You know, it seems like a much more contemporary phrase. That kind of thing, I know it sounds like a snobby nitpick, but it can really take you out of a story that's, you know, attempting to do more than just kind of, you know, scare you or entertain you. So, you know, that was one of the things in it that I also didn't like as much. But
yeah.
Anyway, I'll move on from there. There's a writer I want to talk about who's a contemporary novelist from Mexico. There's a blurb on the front of the book that says this writer's name is Yuri Herrera. And he had written the introduction to the book that his name was Death. And he's a kind of an up-and-coming or a really admired contemporary Mexican novelist that I wanted to make sure to bring in because I've read some of his books. I think he's very interesting. There's one critic named Francisco Goldman, who's also a novelist, who's blurbed out in front of this book I'm holding, is saying, Yuri Herrera is Mexico's greatest novelist. So he's like a guy who really has a high reputation in Mexico. Mm-hmm. I've read three books by him that I want to just mention briefly. They're all like extremely short. I've never seen a book by him that was longer than 120 pages, which I find impressive. Just, you know, for brevity. Yep. Anyway, he has the three books I've read by him are called, there's one novel called Signs Preceding the End of the World. It's about 125 pages. I believe you read that book, John. So you can ring in.
That's right.
Another novel I read by him is even shorter. It's called The Transmigration of Bodies. And the third book I read is an even shorter book of very short stories that he came out with most recently, at least in English, called 10 Planets, that were stories that are very strange and enigmatic, but wildly original in a lot of cases. And those stories, I was so interested to read that book because the book is marketed as kind of Yuri Herrera's collection of short fiction inspired by some of my very favorite writers, people like Kafka, you know, Borges, Philip K. Dick, you know, there was like a whole list of people that inspired him to write these stories. That was like my who's who of like short fiction writing. So I was really interested to read that book. And I mentioned to you kind of off camera, like in Ten Planets, there's the stories are very enigmatic and hard to understand in most cases. But there's one story that's told from the point of view of like literally a microscopic life form inside of a man's lower intestine.
Yeah.
Who, and this is like a 2-page story, who gains consciousness and goes on a journey over 2 pages inside of this man, but then ends up just kind of fading out because the man dies. You know, like, which is kind of crazy. But I guess what I want to say about, because, his one thing that's striking about Yuri Herrera to me, at least what I've read, so there's that book of stories I just mentioned inspired by all those different kind of fantastical writers. His short novel, The Transmigration of Bodies, I don't remember it that well, to be honest. It was only like 115 pages. But it was set in this like kind of futuristic world, like sort of a dystopian world where there were most of the people were dead. And there were these two rival gangs in Mexico that were trading the corpses of people they had killed from the other gang back to the gang they came from in this like dystopian landscape, you know, as kind of the honorable thing to do is return the corpses back to the other gang. But there was this whole kind of treacherous way of doing it, almost like a black market kind of thing. And, you know, if you went afoul of the rules in doing this transfer of bodies from one gang to the other, a whole other war would erupt. And I thought it was like very kind of mysterious and intriguing, that premise. It was also like set in the future. And then,
wow,
Science Preceding the End of the World is about this young woman in Mexico who is, you can help me if I'm not remembering this right, but she's, her brother crossed the border into North America, I believe, and he's kind of like, they lost the trail of him or he's missing, her family. So she's sent over the border on this treacherous journey over the border to try to find out what happened to her brother. But at the same time, she's given like a little package by this local kind of like thug who wants her to be kind of a mule to take this package across the border to another thug over the border, you know,
yep,
in Mexico. And so it's this treacherous journey in a lot of ways. It's this young woman on her own making this journey into across the border into Mexico. And then Yuri Herrera has another novel that I have not read called Kingdom Cons, which is set in like the Middle Ages. And there's like this, I can't remember exactly, but this like troubadour, songster, like puppeteer or something like that is like going through these villages, peddling his wares. I don't really know the story, but that it's just interesting how different these books that are available in the English translation are. And then I noticed in reading his work that all three of the books were really striking. All three of the books were difficult to understand. They were enigmatic. And I said earlier in the episode, John, I don't know anything about translation, but I could discern from reading Yuri Herrera's books that his language must be very, very difficult to translate into English. And I want to just read a little passage from Signposts Preceding the End of the World, and then I'll hand it over to you to give the listener to the show like just an idea of what the language is like in Yuri Herrera's writing. And he always uses the same translator, but this gives you a flavor of the kind of writing that this guy is capable of. And you don't have much context, but it doesn't really matter. So this is from Signposts Preceding the End of the World, and it says, "More than the midpoint between homegrown and Anglo, their tongue is a nebulous territory between what is dying out and what is not yet born, but not a hecatomb." I don't even know what that word means. "Makina," who's the girl who's traveling across the border, "senses in their tongue not a sudden absence, but a shrewd metamorphosis, a self-defensive shift. They might be talking in perfect Latin tongue, and without warning begin to talk in perfect..." Sorry, I skipped the page. "And without warning begin to talk in perfect Anglo tongue and keep it up like that, alternating between a thing that believes itself to be perfect and a thing that believes itself to be perfect, morphing back and forth between two beasts, until out of carelessness or clear intent, they suddenly stop switching tongues and start speaking that other one. In it brims nostalgia for the land they left or never knew when they use the words with which they name objects. While actions are alluded to with an Anglo verb conjugated Latin style, pinning on a sonorous tale from back there. So that's an example of Yuri Herrera's language. You can see how that would be difficult on a translator without being a translator. Yeah. But the last thing I want to say, and I'll hand it over to you to give your impressions of Yuri Herrera, is you can also tell in that passage, I think, I'm not all that smart, but I think what some of what's going on there about the two tongues is sort of interestingly and perhaps deliberately representative of like the porousness of borders between like Mexico and the United States and cultures. And I think that is some of what interests Yuri Herrera. And I think he found an interesting way when he's writing about those two tongues and the way they kind of flow back and forth between the other to sort of illustrate the reality of people maybe who are living in two different cultures or sort of like caught between two different cultures, if I'm making any sense. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, that's there's a lot going on in Yuri Herrera. There's a lot going on even in those comments there, and it's hard to kind of describe what he's getting at. He's, like you said, he's very enigmatic. I found those, his short stories to be too enigmatic. Like I didn't understand what he was getting at in any of them, basically. But even in that one that you mentioned about the microscopic organism, you know, there's something in there about kind of the porousness, you know, of, in that case, it may be like literally membranes, but like, I think you're right. Like, he is interested in the kind of bleeding together of languages, cultures, you know, that go into that part of the world. And right. Obviously right. They bring all of that with them when they come up into, come up El Norte, you know, to the north, you know?
That's right.
So, yeah, I mean, it's very tough to describe and know exactly what he's getting at, but I think you're right that, you know, he's interested in that stuff. And the one that I can comment on is Signs Preceding the End of the World, because that's the short novel that I wrote about the woman, you know, going.
That you read. That you didn't write it.
But what did I say? Wrote? Yeah. I didn't write it, but I read it. you know. Yuri Herrera wrote it, but I read it. But it was really an interesting, you know, story about a woman, first of all, how treacherous it is to cross the border and kind of get into America, which has been something that's been portrayed in a number of different books and movies. But, you know, she had a couple different assignments when she got there, and it was just a really kind of, I don't know, sort of harrowing look at what it takes to cross the border and how, you know, some of what's good and bad from Mexican culture kind of bleeds over the border into the United States, you know?
Right.
Anyway, he's a really interesting writer. I'm glad that he came up and, you know, he's still, sorry about that. He's still writing. So it's going to be interesting to see what he comes out with next. I wanted to.
Yeah.
Make sure that I mention some of the nonfiction books that are on my list. I mean, we're kind of running out of time, and there's so much more that I could say. We're not going to give any of this, you know, sort of fair justice that it deserves, but I did sort of read and dig into, you know, the whole history of Mexico, especially the conquest of Mexico, what they call the conquest. You know, by the Spaniards. There's a huge book that was written in the 19th century by a British historian named William Prescott that's called History of the Conquest of Mexico. It was reissued by the Modern Library. It's kind of one of the most famous histories of that period, which is essentially, you know, the period when Hernan, you know, Cortez came over from Spain in the name of Spain, you know, as a representative of the Spanish crown, and came over to Mexico and eventually, you know, came to what is now Mexico City, met up with Montezuma, who was the Aztec ruler at that time, basically took over the capital, took Mexico essentially for the Spanish crown. And then for the next, what is it, you know, 300 years? I believe it's 300 years. Spain had control over Mexico until Mexico achieved their own independence, which is, I think, the origins for the Cinco de Mayo holiday. But anyway, Prescott's huge book, he also wrote a mammoth book that was called The History of the Conquest of Peru. So, you know, he wrote two books about conquistadors coming over and taking over both Mexico and Peru. Anyway, his book about the history of the conquest of Mexico, though written in kind of an arcane 19th century style, is just an absolutely fascinating account of Cortez's entire campaign in Mexico, or I should say two campaigns, because he was in Mexico for a period of time, actually ended up going back to Spain, sort of like re-upping all of his, you know, men and weapons and supplies and stuff, came back and took over. It wasn't called Mexico City, but took over Montezuma's capital and basically took the entire country for Spain. But this is a sprawling, you know, epic history that goes very deep into, you know, Aztec culture and also many of the other, you know, civilizations that were there before the Aztecs. You have the Olmecs, you have the, I'm going to get some of these words wrong. I don't want to get the names of the races wrong, but there were many races before the Aztecs and the Mayans all over the entire, you know, country of Mexico that had different sort of cultures there and tribes. And it's just a huge book kind of, you know, describing the entire conquest of Mexico, which is just fascinating stuff. You know, I still haven't finished the book. The book's about 800 pages long. You know, I've read about 500 pages or so of it, but it's just awesome. It's a great history, and it's based in large degree on a firsthand account that was written by somebody who was traveling with Cortez and kind of like basically chronicling the whole epic journey. So that's an incredible history of that period of Mexican history that I would highly recommend. It's in the Modern Library series. But, you know, we don't have time to go over it all. There's at least three books that I wanted to bring up that are nonfiction books that are about Mexico kind of in our contemporary time. And each of them focuses on something a little bit different. I'll just mention them briefly. There's a book called Murder City, Ciudad Juarez, and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields, written by Charles Bowden. And that's basically focuses on the city of Juarez and its sort of violent history over the last 50 years. So you touched on this before, Jude, with the Lost Girls of Juarez and kind of the, like, this book just describes what a dangerous place that is right across the border from El Paso, and just gets deep into those awful crimes that have been committed there in the last several decades. That's a riveting book of kind of like true crime reportage. And Charles Bowden, man, he doesn't hold back. That book it's brutal. There's a book called The Devil's Highway, a true story, which is by Luis Alberto Uria. And that's a book that focuses on, it's a true story that focuses on a group of men who are trying to come up from Mexico and cross the border into Arizona. And there's a particular stretch of desert that they have to cross once they're into the United States, or it might be just before, I'm not sure. And it has a name, I can't remember the name, but It's kind of, you know, there's a group of like 30 Mexican men and maybe only 8 survived the trip. And he's kind of just beat by beat. He sort of chronicles who these people were. He tells in, you know, really like moving and kind of poignant detail how some of these men were trying to just build a better life for their families. One guy was like a roofer with like a young wife and kid back in Mexico. And he was literally just trying to like make money to send back home, which is so common of a story. But this is like a really detailed book that tells about the journey that they made and how most of them didn't survive. They were not prepared for that stretch of desert, which is over 50 miles that they had to cross, called the Devil's Highway. So it's just a really, you know, reading a book like that, it just really kind of, as much as it's possible, it puts you in the shoes of, you know, some of these migrants and immigrants and what they have to go through to even cross the border and how just insanely dangerous it is. And it also, this book is, you know, balanced enough that he interviews many like border patrol officers, and he describes the way that they try to help some of these migrants who are coming over. And, but you know, they can't help everybody. And there's one guy who's a border patrol officer who in his own spare time, like on the weekends, would build these like towers that were stations for migrants who were crossing the desert and just providing them with like clothing or water. And it was just like, it's just a really detailed, well-reported story about immigrants trying to make that trek. And it's just very moving. And then there's one more book. I won't say much about this because I haven't read it. It's called Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey Through a Country's Descent into Darkness by Alfredo Corchado. And it's basically like kind of a modern history of drug cartel activity in Mexico. And this young guy was, you know, the author, Alfredo Corchado, is of Mexican descent. But he starts working for a Dallas paper, I believe, newspaper. And he gets sent down to report on the activity of various drug cartels in Mexico City and surrounding areas. And as he gets immersed in it, he kind of gets too close to it. And there's basically death threats that are put on his head. So now he's sort of running for his life. And it's kind of this account of you know, some of the very dangerous activity that's kind of ripping the country apart ever since this gets a little more detail than we need, but Vicente Fox was elected president of Mexico in the year 2000, and he kind of vowed to take on the drug cartels. But, you know, they eventually took over enough so that he was driven out of office. And it was during his presidency in the early 2000s that was kind of this real ascendancy of some of these Mexican drug cartels. And he just kind of lost control of things. He was elected as a reformer, and Mexico kind of descended into this sort of nightmarish situation that I think to a large degree they're still in. And so this book by Alfredo Corchado kind of, you know, digs deep into that. And so like we were talking about the Don Winslow books, you know, these are kind of like thrillers meant to entertain, but Corchado's book is about the real deal and about how he becomes a target for some of these drug cartels and how he's running for his life, trying to protect his family, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, there are a lot of great books out there that are kind of reporting on what the current situation is in Mexico. And a lot of that stuff is really, you know, riveting, but it's also kind of heartbreaking. So I wanted to be sure that we mentioned some of those. You know, a couple of those I have read, one of them I haven't, but they all sound really, really interesting to me.
Aside from the big history that you talked about, those last three, did you say you've read all three of those or you haven't read all three of those? Or no, the last one you have not read.
No, the first two I read. Actually, the first one, Murder City by Charles Bowden, I didn't technically read it. I heard it on audio. Luis Urrea's book, The Devil's Highway, I read. I'd really like to read Midnight in Mexico, but I haven't.
Okay.
So yeah. just so you know, there's one other nonfiction book that I wanted to at least mention, but I don't think we've gotten everything you wanted to mention. And we're kind of running low on time, but what haven't we talked about that you have to bring up?
Well, no, I think I'm okay, and I know we're running out of time, but there's one other book I just want to mention by name that I read that didn't turn out to really be applicable, but I thought it was worth mentioning because of its merit, in my opinion. I chose to read a book, and it was also written by a woman, and I really liked this book, so I just want to throw it out there. The book, it's a famous novel from the 1980s. It's called The House on Mango Street.
Oh, yeah.
It was written by Sandra Cisneros. I got it out of the library because I thought it was a book about Mexico. It's actually set in the United States. She and the young woman in the book are of Mexican descent, but the book really didn't have to do with Mexico directly. But I thought it was a great book, though. It's a pretty well-known book, and a lot of people admire it. It's a very short book. It's about this teenage girl growing up in Chicago in the middle of the 20th century who's from a Mexican family. And she's in kind of like an impoverished part of the city, and she's sort of embarrassed of her house, you know, the titular house on Mango Street, which has a lot of people living in it. And it's these like very short, very short poetic anecdotes about like her neighbors, basically, in the neighborhood that she lives in. And sort of this young woman is kind of coming of age, sort of flowering into womanhood in this book. And I just thought it was really beautifully written, kind of moving, kind of interesting portrayal of a young woman of Mexican descent living in the United States. And it kind of had the specter of Mexico and Mexican culture over it. But it wasn't really about Mexico. It was more about this young woman, you know, kind of living in the United States. But it's a really good book, so I wanted to mention it. Other than that, though, I'm good. What more did you want to say?
Well, I'm glad you brought up The House on Mango Street. That's a well-known book. And I've seen it in many used bookstores, library sales, etc. It kind of has its own reputation, but I'm glad you got it in there. That's just the story of, like, you know, a female Mexican immigrant who's living in one of the major U.S. cities and just kind of about her life. I think that's a perspective that is really important to get in here. So I'm glad you were able to work that in.
I admired the book, so I wanted to mention
it. Yeah, I mean, there's certainly, you know, hundreds of thousands of people that probably fit into that category.
Sure.
Yeah, there's a couple other books I wanted to bring up. I'm going to have to do it quickly. So back at the beginning of this discussion, I talked about, you know, Mexican writers that kind of have to be read. I missed one of the most important ones. And this one did win the Nobel Prize. And his name is Octavio Paz. Probably, you know, maybe the most famous, best-known writer from Mexico, period. But you actually, I believe you gave this to me many, many years ago. He has a very famous volume of essays called The Labyrinth of Solitude. Mm-hmm. And I read most of this book. It's comprised of a big, long essay called The Labyrinth of Solitude and has like four or five others. I read the big long essay, and of the four or five others I've read, I think three of them. And I was not prepared. I just don't know, as we said from the outset, I don't know enough about Mexican history, Mexican culture, anything like that to really. I struggled when I first read The Labyrinth of Solitude, but I went back and read portions of it for this discussion and then a couple of the other essays. And I'll just say this, like, that is a collect. If anybody who wants to understand recent Mexican history, or even, you know, going back to the conquest, kind of how Mexico got to where it is now, and what are the origins for some of its biggest problems right now, That is a must read. There is a essay called Mexico and the United States in there that compares Mexican history and how Mexico was founded to how the United States was founded. And it's just fascinating. Like, he makes a huge deal, and I never really thought about it before, Jude. He makes a huge deal about how different it is that the United States was founded by people coming over from like Britain and their religious traditions versus the Spaniards coming over and establishing Catholicism. You know, if you know anything about American history, when Europeans came over, they were not representing the Catholic Church. You know, there were some Catholics that came over, but the American founding has nothing to do with Rome. But in Spain, when they came over, they were claiming Mexico for the Catholic Church. And as a result of that, the two histories have taken very wildly different trajectories. And then you layer, of course, the Catholic Church and what its interests were on top of all these indigenous cultures that had been there for a long time. See, in the United States, we didn't interact with the indigenous cultures. We just pushed them aside. And eventually, we just kept pushing them west and eventually put them on their own reservations and just like didn't deal with them. But in Mexico, it's a totally different story. It was like one layer on top of another layer. And they intermixed in Mexico. And that totally colors Mexican history and Mexican culture. For example, that's why the Day of the Dead is such a big deal there to this day, because that goes all the way back to indigenous culture. So it's just Octavio Paz kind of unpacks a lot of this. And, you know, if you're interested at all in the history of Mexico, you can't miss that book, The Labyrinth of Solitude. And then there's one more book I want to bring up because I said that I was going to talk about different categories. My category for this book is unclassifiable. There's a recent book. It's a novel. It's called The Story of My Teeth by a young Mexican woman writer named Valeria Luiselli. And she writes this really strange novel about a person, a guy who's born in Mexico City, and he grows up to become this famous, world-famous auctioneer. But he, this is going to be strange to even try to describe. He describes his life and how he finds these like artifacts or interesting objects and he auctions them off. And he gets interested in the teeth of different famous figures throughout history. Like he himself personally wears the teeth of Marilyn Monroe. And like he has teeth from like, I don't know, Winston Churchill or Goethe or G.K. Chesterton is one of them for some reason. And he, like, these are part of his personal collection. But the character also, part of his life story is that he worked at this juice factory in like a rural part of Mexico. And Valeria Luiselli, the author, when she was researching this book, she, this is very strange, but she like interacted with actual factory workers from this factory that's down in rural Mexico. And so she was writing kind of about this factory that actually exists and weaving it into her novel. So she decided to, quote unquote, co-write some of the chapters with the employees of the factory. So she would write parts of the book and she would mail them down to these factory workers with little to no education and ask them to kind of read what she had written and comment on it. And she'd get their comments and she'd incorporate it into the book. So it's this weird kind of collective novel in a way that's written by this woman, but also with input from these factory workers down in Mexico, which I thought was a fascinating idea. I don't know if that makes any sense to you or anybody else who might be listening to this, but it ends up being this very quirky story about life in a certain poor part of Mexico, far away from Mexico City or any of the famous sort of urban centers. And it's kind of this novel that's written, weaving together many voices, but also this kind of outrageous story of this guy whose ambition is to become the world's greatest auctioneer. It's very strange, but I thought it was really interesting. And in ways that I guess I probably don't even understand, it kind of reflects something of the current, I don't know, melting pot or richness that exists in Mexico. So anyway, I'm still kind of processing that novel, but it was only a couple, it was from a couple years ago. You can look it up if you have any interest. It's called The Story of My Teeth. And it was really, really unique, if nothing else. So I wanted to make sure I mentioned that because it was, it's a contemporary novel coming out of Mexico, written by a female writer.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you did. And she's a writer of some renown. Like, she has some other books. Certainly heard her name before. That does sound like a really strange bird, but wildly unique in a way. And I think what you just said there at the end may be correct. Like, if I had read it myself, I might have the same sense, which is that perhaps it's reflective of some of the aspects of contemporary Mexico that just by necessity and by definition of who you and I are, John, like, we just, we're not there in terms of comprehension.
Right. Well, that's a lot. As always, we've given our listeners a lot to chew on and think about, or maybe they're asleep by now. Who knows? But that is Read Around the World Mexico, brought to you by the Book Exchange Podcast. We're going to wrap things up. Let's talk really quick about what we might have coming up next, and then we can just tease the next episode and get out of here.
All right. Well,
What's in the on deck circle for you?
Well, probably a lot of different things, you know, related to some of the episodes we're talking about planning. But I'll just say this: I'm going to go back at some point and finish reading The Dark Descent, that horror anthology. Got about 150 pages left.
Nice.
Maybe 6 or 7 stories. So I'm looking forward
Keep
to that.
Keep at it.
Last one. The last one is by Philip K. Dick, one of my favorite writers, from that science fiction episode that we're going to take on one of these.
Yeah, years. Someday.
And then I'm also going to be reading, I'm stealing a little thunder from one of the episodes down the road, but that's okay. Because I'm reading some short stories by one of our all-time favorites, John, between the two of us, Flannery O'Connor. And I'm reading it. Well, there's a movie coming out about Flannery O'Connor that we talked about offline, so that makes me want to revisit some of her stories. But I'm actually going to be reading these stories in connection, sort of as research for two totally different things. One of them may be related to a podcast that we're going to do in the future. They'll come up at some point. And then also, I'm writing a novel about Thomas Merton, the famous Trappist monk, who's a fan of Flannery O'Connor. And there's a scene that I want to write in which he's discussing Flannery O'Connor's stories with a fictional student who he's mentoring at the Trappist monastery where he lived. So I'm reading those stories for that reason as well. And then I'll move on to some other books, which we don't have to mention quite yet. So that's what's coming up next for me. The rest of The Dark Descent, going to reread some Flannery O'Connor stories. Always a good time. Can't wait for that. What's up next for you?
All right, so I'll talk about that, and then I'm just going to segue into teasing the next episode, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
So you kind of stole my thunder a little bit, but that's okay. I, too, am going to be rereading some Flannery O'Connor next. And for similar reasons, I mean, I'm not writing a novel. Let's make that clear. But there is that movie coming out pretty soon called Wildcat about Flannery O'Connor. We are making some loose plans to perhaps talk about Flannery O'Connor in some depth in the near future. So I'll just leave it at that. But I'm going to be rereading her second and last book of short stories called Everything That Rises Must Converge. I think I've only read that collection once, so I'm really looking forward to digging into those stories again. Her first, perhaps better known, volume of short stories, A Good Man is Hard to Find. I know I've read at least twice. This one I'm not so sure. So I'm looking forward to getting into what became some of her last stories published before she died, unfortunately, at the too early age of 39 of lupus. So I'll be joining you in the Flannery O'Connor Fest coming up soon. Now, to wrap things up for our next episode, which is episode 60, kind of sort of a fun milestone. We think this is going to be a really interesting one. We're going to talk about memoirs. And that's going to be the focus of the next episode. And this is actually prompted by a comment that was made to me by one of my sons, who had to read two different memoirs for school assignments. And he said to me once at the dinner table, he's like, "Dad, I read these two books. They were pointless. I don't understand why people feel like they have to tell us their life stories, especially when they had sort of traumatic upbringings." And we'll get into what those books were when we have the episode. But he went on this kind of semi-rant about whether memoirs are really necessary. And it got me thinking, like, what is it that makes a memoir really famous and quote-unquote classic? And why do we have so many memoirs written today, especially by celebrities? But, like, you know, presidents always have to write a memoir. Sports figures have to write a memoir. Celebrities have to write their memoir. You know, why do we need all these memoirs? And what is it that makes for a really good, valuable memoir? So that's the sort of topic that we're working on for the next episode, episode 60. It was prompted by my son's kind of semi-rant. I may see if I can get him to ring in on it. I don't know. He's in college, so he's pretty busy. But I think we're going to have a really interesting discussion about maybe a little bit more philosophical. Like, what is it that really makes a memoir stand the test of time or effective or memorable? And then maybe discuss some of our favorites. So that's on the docket for episode 60. Jude, what do you have to comment about that?
I will just say, I think it's going to be really fascinating. I think your son's, you know, as I think about it, I think your son's, and we'll unpack this later, but I think your son's comment, in a way, is kind of a youthful comment.
Yep.
And in a way, makes a lot of sense. And it'll just be fun for us to unpack that whole genre a little bit. And then I'm really looking forward to seeing what are the memoirs from both you and from me that really kind of stand out as kind of like worthy of our time and our opinion. It's going to be a really fun discussion and an interesting one.
That's right. So if you're one of the many, many, many readers out there who have read books like, I don't know, The Glass Castle or Educated or Hillbilly Elegy, or maybe you really enjoyed, you know, Promised Land by Barack Obama. There's so many. You know, this episode may be for you if you're interested in, or you've enjoyed, you know, memoirs in the past. So we'll see. I think it could lead to some really interesting discussion. That's what we're going to take on for episode 60. That brings us to the end of episode 59. So thank you if you've made it this far. We always kind of joke about that, but listen, we try to, like, it's like when you go to a sub sandwich place and you get like a thin sandwich, you walk out of there and you're disappointed, right? It's like there's two strips of meat in here, but you go to other you go to other places and, you know, the sandwich is stuffed and you go like, I can barely finish this thing. You know, that's what we try to do. We try to give you a stuffed sandwich here at the Book Exchange podcast. So, yeah. You know, right. It's basically, it's your money's worth, right, Jude?
Yeah, you know, you go into Subway and you get like a sandwich and you're disappointed. You can go for the double meat.
That's right.
And we try to give you the double meat, you know, which sort of maybe dovetails with the twin theme. So, you know.
If you want a sandwich that you can like shove under your door and like keep it open, that's fine. You can go to other podcasts. But
I mean, people say less is more. You know, in the Book Exchange podcast, more.
That's right. If you want a sandwich you can't even fit your mouth around, Well, you come to the right place. You know, like, that's the Book Exchange. So anyway, signing off for another episode. Thanks for listening, as always. Jude, have a good night, man.
You too, John. Great discussion. We'll see y'all
later. All right, thanks.